spot real 10. Would you continue your description of the escape at Eichstatt, Mr. Scott?
Yes, certainly. I think it will be realized by what has been said to this point that the whole operation was very extensive and was conducted in a manner which got men from the Henry, the top Henry, lay in wait, waiting for their turn to be called. Out of the 34 that were first agreed to arrive, and then later it went so well that the whole 64 or 5 got out. So what the drill was that you lay in the roof racks up there quietly. There's a lot of tension, a lot of sweating, and it reminds me of some of the chaps you see in films where their aircraft was and you drop a parachute, you're not used to it or something like that. It was highly tensionizing. Once you left there and your number was called, you went to the little Henry and picked up your pack, which was all numbered and backed down, and the rope would be made suitable for putting the chap in front of you, who's had his pack, and the fellow behind you would have your pack. And the rope would be down and released. You go down the stairs to one or two points where you find a fellow prisoner comfortable in every respect. And a wonderful loudspeaker called him, super. And then you would pop down the hole with a few more fairy things, and you found somebody sitting at the bottom there in a carbide lamp, and right up you go, and then you sauntered away up here under the coffin. Then well, the coffin was just in the roof, it was a massive great stone. And then we went on up to the belly hall, which was a bit awkward, but so many people had got through it that that was exaggerated a bit possibly, but it was rather awkward. And then when you got up to the Piccadilly area, there was another good friend there, cheering down, nothing to do with going out themselves, they were helping everybody out. And they'd say, when we're all out now, the sod of earth would be, have been removed by the time that the movement started proper. And the fresh air would suddenly come roaring in, and it was sweet smelling, and no doubt. It was like dew night, and it was really good. Out having been in this rather stifling atmosphere. So that was a sort of continuous progress right through until the last chaps got out. The exit itself was, it was intended to cover it up so that it could be used again at another time, but I think that was a little bit of thinking really. But there was a severe restriction about the whole of this, which I think it might go on to, because I don't think there's anything, well, water bottles were not allowed to be taken through to fill because of the weight and size, and you had to do that when they came out.
In the term you were saying, you mentioned one or two people strategically placed in the tent. We're not going out,
no.
But we're just helping you along.
Helping
so just in that line.
Oh, yes, yes, there were people who were in little niches, you see.
Yes,
you'd be going up there and they'd be sort of huddled in the corner or made a little parking place for themselves.
So they must have been down there quite a long time.
Oh, yes, they did a magnificent job. Like Jack Hales, who's a regular gunner, who got off a train and came out in Poland. He was one of them, and he was a few chap up here, up at the top of the belly hall, in that area, anyway.
Before you go on with the rest of it, can I ask you about ventilation? We haven't dealt with the ventilation.
Yes. Well, what happened was, it was rather clever, you see, we had some bright sparks on the ground. That chap was in the washroom, So it isn't a non-starter for air control and all that. But what did happen was that when the tunnel came through here, and that way, it came to a fireplace into this room, and there were holes drilled rather like a maxi fire in the base of this, so that the airflow flowed straight through, and the draft took all the smoke and everything else straight up into the roof of the building. And it was never sure, it never appeared at all, so it was just a modern maxi fire.
So the tunnel started in, I think it's in room 2, they've got to Washington.
Yes, got to.
And then went underneath the huts for the buildings.
No, it didn't go very far because it was very, very close together. And it was the room virtually next door to them.
Which so they the ventilation.
Just put the holes in to get the suction and the drag up. In fact, I never went up there at all. Something I didn't know about, but I know about it from having read about it since.
How long was the tunnel from the wash room to its actual exit?
It was 113 feet.
And by then you've gone under the ground, underneath the wire.
Under the wire, yes.
It was rolled outside. It was rolled out, you said, outside.
Yes. It works something like this. You'd have a strong wire fence there. That would be about 8 feet high. And just down here, there'd be a trip bar. And the reason
for that fence.
Yes, and if anybody crossed over that, the trap in the gun turret, you know how they have these turrets, the end of prisoner war camps, with a machine gun up there, you'd machine gun you, or warn you.
But what
size
was the tripwire from the ground?
That old. Mm-hmm. 18 inches from there. It used to get over. I mean, I only knew one man who did, and that was up in here, so. BC champ, yes. Amazing, but a bit daft to him. Anyway, that was the hurdle to get over. And remember, the Borberg, who ran, ramps run up to allow people to run flat out over the top and come down the other side of the road.
Because you're going underneath.
We're underneath. We come from here, under that, under the big thing. Then there's a tarmac road running right down to a village further down. That's where we're under that. And then so we had the road. We could hear people chipping away up here. The sound of the acoustic system was good on the road. But, you know, if this chap spotted anybody coming along, we were walking on, he'd stop the work at the coal face side business dead.
Yes, you're describing to me the warning system as the men, as the people were going up. Could you put it on a tape? The warning system for anyone coming down the road as you were going up, or as you were about to go up. The rope and the clutch.
Well, yes, I don't think that. No, I don't think it can, because the clutches, I don't think it actually operated at all. Because I think nearly all of it was dismantled because we expected to go in and out. And it would have been an encumbrance. I couldn't quite be honest to it.
It had been intended to use something that meant to where the signal was given.
Oh, definitely, yes. And in one case, they had, and I didn't see this, but I understood they had an electric cable in for one part of it, but I wasn't sufficiently familiar with it. But I think the experience of going from that Henry down to Little Henry down there, and all these chaps placed, it was very encouraging. And then when you got to that point where you came out, then you're on your own, very nearly on your own, because Penman was off top. But that is another story.
Penman was a gentleman who came out early and
went, yes, he
looked up the bank
Yes. Yes. I'd like to put him into the right perspective because he was a very old man. This is digressing from the mechanics of this to the listener. In May, a note was found inside the camp saying by a German, left by a German, that the Germans knew all about this town and that if anybody came out of it, they would be machine gunned and there were landmines in the rock face, and that in other words, they would be exposed and shot. Well, that caused a hell of a hoo-ha. The committee went, I'm speaking now not off the cuff because I wasn't there, obviously, but I know what came out of it because I knew certain people. This caused an awful stir. Should we go or should we not go? I mean, after all that work, and that was one day. The next day, another note was found saying that they knew what the tunnel was and begged us not to put our lives in jeopardy and this sort of thing. And they had every single person in the camp, they never knew it, I'm quite sure, handwriting checked. Which was an amazing business, and they limited it down to two people, and they never said whether it was a German or a British chap, either of them, and they were pretty nearly certain that they were at that point. Everybody had their handwriting checked. Not that they had, I don't think, a special handwriting expert, but sufficient to know whether someone was faked up. Well, that was a hell of a hole on the whole thing. And the decision then had to be made, well, should they break the tunnel or not? So, I think that everybody was asked whether they were family men or not, whether they had, relations or any sort of domestic problem. Maybe it would be if the family was there. There wasn't anybody. Everybody was doing this primitive for long enough and worked at it in all aspects and they went off. So
do you feel that they may have known it was a prisoner by the fact that they did go?
Well, I can't honestly answer that. There were two people apparently were. They might all prisoners at that kind of a bit pushy. All of it on. There's nobody saying, no, I mean, any kind of that. It was recognized that some people were a bit more than others, but it's just one of those things. I don't know. There was no comment made about it.
Who was the first man on the team?
Frank Weldon. He opened the top. Hamilton Bailey. And
you didn't describe Penny's role on top of the bank.
Well, it was decided that in order to go up a mountain side, or the mountain side here, it was a very steep thing. And we just come out of the washing camp and came out there. We then had to go up this thing, and it was like a cavalry charge on mountain. Pastor dropped my bottle or lost a shoe or something. It's not a cavalry charge. In the middle of the night, you could hear a pin drop. I've never heard it. More good luck than good management. But I think the thing is, when we arrived at the top here, and we exhausted, and we lay down, we looked down the perimeter lights all around the camp. That was a moment of anxiety.
What was the feeling?
Oh, it was static, absolutely. Because just to be the other side of the wall, simple as that. And I mean, whether you got away completely or not, the fact that you got out of the place, whether you've been there or anywhere else, it was a wonderful feeling.
And I think you said
how
he went up the top of it.
He went up, yes, with a rope. In fact, I never saw the rope at all, but it would be there. And he would play. he's a brave chap, because he would be the fellow who captured if they were from the machine gun anybody.
But he was seeing
everyone. He was seeing them all. But, well, I think they got to the point where everybody knew that once they got to the top of the hill, they were off on the trick. And that is a long story. What happened to people after they got out there.
Before we move on to that story, you mentioned Carius and David Lawrence.
Yes.
The whole operation, the whole organisation, food, clothing, and documents, can you go into that?
Well, to a degree, yes. I mentioned that Colonel Merritt's partner, Colonel Levert, had to forego his place with Diane, and one of the Canadians, other Canadians took it. And Colonel Merritt said, now, if you're short of rations, then this hamburger, so that you have some of mine. Documents have been made for you, the route that you're taking and the place you're going to go to, if you can get to it, and there's some safe house or point, and all these things were made clear to him and to others. So there was a sort of little cottage industry, I think, in the background, people doing documents and this sort of thing, time passing and getting the German tickets and the clothing and all that sort of thing. Some German
cars. How were they able to obtain the originals to copy?
Well, that was really a bit of skullduggery with the German sentries and people like that, you know, because they were pretty soft sort of blokes, were they? And they'd say, there were certain people in the camp, there was a couple of Smith, who was an Egyptian. You can get anything, it's extraordinary. Amazing man. But there were one or two out there who could somehow get things. And, for instance, Jack Hamilton Bailey made a sewing machine. Complete sewing machine. So, doing all the clothes up, he was a brilliant chap. And,
what materials were you able to use?
Well, in fact, rather funny, I should say. I was able myself to obtain a Burberry Mac, which was surprising. A Brownfield officer in the 9th Battalion DLI, and I said to him at the time, would he let me have it to go out in? It was not a light colour, but a sort of semi-civil sort of colour. And I said, I'll give you £5 for it. And in those days, it was worth it. And I see a man at green reunions, and he says, you stay out of that coat. But remember that by this time in the war, parcels had been sent from home and all sorts of clothing and that sort of thing. And the usual ink and durable things, and just applying stuff to turn out, you know, something civil look instead of military.
It must have been quite ingenious to be able to obtain some of this equipment and material.
Well, I think I could say this. You were either a documentator, a sir, or a sort of that type of person, or you were a bit more basic and you're using the shovel to do things. But a lot of these chaps are very clever. We had a hatter, Ron Johnson was a hatter from England. And I think he's German. Andrew Edgar, for instance, was the other one. He was a wonderful skill, I believe. But one only got smatterings of this in conversation, you know. One wasn't doing on everything, if you know what I mean. I think it's also a good thing I wasn't, because that's a little too much. And all these things were really secret where they were done.
Have you any idea just how long it would take from the initial approval that an estate would be made to the actual estate taking place from the point of view of the length of time digging and preparing documents and clearing, what kind of period of time would that take?
I think six months at least. At least.
And did you get talks on how it was, well, how it was done?
No.
We all part in it.
Yes.
No,
what happened there was that there were certain addresses which were known, and they were either being sent in letters or friends or something like that. So that if you set off, you could do one or two things. You could go to the railway station if it's worth going, and buy a ticket, and you'd be able to get a large mark. And there are ways and means of getting these things, you know. Or you could say, well, I'm going to see the moons, as most of us did, I'm going to say. Travel at night and sleep up during the day. And we did that fairly successfully, except that this particular exercise was, they turned out 60,000 troops, which was staggering. It was 1,000 per head. The place was alive with Germans. Every bush and they were waiting for us.
You mentioned German money, those of you that use it, how did they obtain that? Was that through the guards?
I don't know, to be truthful.
Did they make their own copies?
I don't think money, I think they get money. It did transpire lastly that the Lager mark, that was a camp mark, was worth more on their open market than the stock ration mark, which is surprising. That's the way it worked out. But I was never involved really with transactions of that type. But they weren't.
In your pack, you say you had food.
Yes.
Well, where did that come from? How did you accumulate?
Well, you had to save up there. It was really funny, an unwritten law that you didn't use Red Cross food to escape. A lot of people did. But the thing that you take, and the things that I took when we arrived, was oats, which you get in the Red Cross pack, chocolate, particularly made of vitamin types. Because I had the same rice for chocolate, and they don't get so much. Really, the sort of things that you had with you. We took a little stove. Chenham and I had a little stove, so we had them brew up in the early hours of the June morning on top of a railway cutter. And they're nice too.
And how did you get the stove?
Oh, we made it out of tins. This stove was a straightforward, simple thing.
And how did you hide it? What was the hiding?
Nothing is complicated. I think it was probably swabs and matches or something. I honestly don't remember. We got the thing I liked then.
But you got out, and I think you inferred that you were in pairs.
Yes.
And was the information
you had to
split?
Scattered? No, not at all. It was a personal thing, man. Lots of times went to. But I had a really extraordinary experience with the chocolate, bringing to this every year. Ken Herman, I was a hill of that, when I went out there, so we got on there. There was no nonsense in there. And we agreed to circle around the farm or two with a dog's foot barking on the right and the other, like a June morning. And we had no water because water, we didn't take it in to our packs coming out of the tunnel. We were absolutely dying for a drink. We were walking on the edge of the wood and right down to the bottom of this wood. There was a stream in this little thing to hold all the way down, it filled up. So we went all the way down to the bottom, but when we got down there, it was like the light shining on leaves, glistening on leaves. And really, after having pulled out of the tunnel and done that, it was such a disappointment. We got back up, and we had to cross a railway line. So we went over this railway line, into the river headfirst, but it's really safe down for the water. And then we made our way back to it along the line to where the tunnel had been done, and they shouted out and said, just to stop the tunnel, and they asked us to hide from them. So we got in there and had our porridge, and while we were in there, there's some 72 people turned up in the rooms, looking through the rooms, and a little bit quiet. And it was about getting people over. And my daughter, about 12, was young there. And the old chap ran down the hill when he saw us and left his daughter over there with us by the side, or quite near us, a few rooms in. So he gave us some chocolate, that's what she was after. Looked up the skirts and put it in the trousers and said, "Snow, come off the road." And the difference between me and boy was, and she said virtually in short, so we didn't understand the German, it could go after us.
What were you
some very civilian looking clothes, really. Dyed trousers. And this mat, this famous mat, which is just a muddy fellow. But we were working, basically. If we were going to be stopped in there, that's why we have to. Yes, without a doubt. But there was a reason for that, because Hitler had brought out an instruction that any Russian would be shot on sight. Prisoner. And we'd heard this, and of course, this said by us, they said we were Russians. Or could have done, but there were no quarter of them given at all, shocking. And we didn't see it happen, but they were near at hand.
Did you move on quickly then from this place?
Yes, we did. We moved, we fainted, we went off like this way, and then doubled back. And we heard no more from this chap at all. We went into hiding. In a cornfield with a plastic cutter machine turned up at the far corner of the room, taking the slices of the thing from that. And luckily, it was sufficiently far away from it. We hear them talking, chatting, and having lunch and that sort of thing. In the daylight, we, of course, we were hidden. And then when the evening came, they dispersed and we. First two, so off we went. And another day, the same sort of thing. We had 2 days of that. And then the third night, we were going towards Stuttgart, that's where we were waiting for. And what happened now? Yes, suddenly, a couple of guns turned up, that's a game keeper. Another old chap and him to hell, and then they didn't know. Both Ken and I agreed that without speaking to each other, we wouldn't go around because, a countryman with a shotgun and another one with a rifle, we wouldn't know hope. So we had to hang the hell and then that sort of thing. And they were quite nice old boys, actually. We were just sort of going to make tracks for the village, and a whole lot of Hitler Jugend turned up. They even shoot us. No, I mean, it could be an art sort of reason. So they were going to shoot him. And these two men, they saved our lives with this. I think they were about 10 or 12, armed to the teeth. Because it was a great game for them to find the prisoner, because everybody in the place knew that they would be escaping in the end. And that was very satisfactory. So they took us to the village police, the little room then. And these two chaps said, "Well, you better eat your own food, otherwise we'll have to confiscate it." And so we started to do that. And you wouldn't believe this. So knock on the door, and the door opened, and all of these Hitler Jugend came in, and one came out with his badges and his short trousers and all this. And he said, "Please, sir, could we have some chocolate?" In English. You wouldn't credit it, would you? And he usually thought of himself as a clay or something. So it didn't pass through the game or something. Eventually. But I thought, well, that's how crazy can you get? So these chaps then said, well, in the morning, we'll put you in a lorry and send you back to Ashdod. Well, of course, we were very disappointed. We thought we'd be the only ones caught. No, I think we got 55 in the room when we got back there. We rounded them up. It was a huge exercise for them. They had the head of their history union, the land force, and everybody. It's in the press. And they were terrified, of course, that that big break was going to cause the problem of the resolving our own thing. Where they went out with 100 minutes to fill. But it's rather interesting that, because I was looking at some notes, I was trying to remember.